Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk.
This would be the Media Project, where you have a half hour of commentary, analysis, and if we're lucky, a little insight into the media issues of the week. And we will be discussing El Chapo, not-for-profit journalism, naming names and rape stories. I bet we'll get to all that.
Oh, sure. If we can keep Alan in control.
And we will try. That's Rosemary Armeo, professor at the University of Albany and investigative journalist, and Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, Professor Emeritus Hebe also, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here to talk about all these issues. Really, we probably better start off with El Chapo because it combines these things that we find impossible to avoid in journalism. We love celebrity and we love crime, and you put it together, and here it is, Sean Penn interviewing El Chapo for Rolling Stone.
And there's even a love interest involved.
It's going to be
a great movie.
Yeah. Did anybody really think that El Chapo was doing this so that he could see Sean Penn? No.
He didn't even know who Sean Penn was. Right. Couldn't pronounce his name. Uh-huh. Shan, he called him. Who's this guy again? Come on, Toots. I want to meet you. Awful. I hate that this is
and
being presented as...
Who is the woman involved?
Kate Del Castillo. She is a Mexican actress who plays a drug lordess, not a lord.
I find her
very attractive.
And
El Chapo is already married to a beauty queen, just wanted to meet her. So she goes, yeah, bring your little friend along and we'll have a chat.
Well,
and
not
Rolling
exactly.
Stone presents this as gotcha journalism, stuff that real journalists couldn't get. We didn't get this great interview. And it's a piece of junk. There's nothing in there that's new or interesting, remotely interesting. It is a puff piece for El Chapo. And I've been fuming about this piece.
So aside from the fact that you don't like the piece, aside from the journalism critique of the work of Sean Penn, what about the notion of going down and getting the story of the drug lord? What if he had been a better journalist?
What if it had been a real journalist who'd done it? Then I think you would have had questions that were more fair and complete. This made El Chapo look good. This isn't a long line of journalism that makes the bad guys, the crooks, look like heroes. It turned Robin Hood and Jesse James into folk heroes instead of presenting them as they really were. And that's what you get with El Chapo.
Well, I don't know that Robin Hood was bad. Jesse James had his issues.
They all are. I mean, here's the truth. I mean, I cover crime and corruption around the world, and you do not begin to go get these guys until you present an accurate picture of who they are. When the mafia was presented as all dons and handsome and great and good fellows, the public cheered them on. It was only when you began presenting them as the murderers and crooks and deadly people they are. Sean Penn didn't come close to that. He might as well have hired a scriptwriter.
Okay, now I have certain objections the way you carry on, Rosemary, and here's one of them. I love the fact that you, quite frequently, are the one who decides on who is a journalist and who isn't a journalist. No, wait, because I know guys who write for the New York POST, and they write drivel or whatever.
I believe that's pronounced
and they decide who's a journalist and who isn't a journalist also, you know, which is the height of hypocrisy as far as I'm concerned. So therefore, no, what are you making those faces
because
for?
Because it's a ridiculous argument. I don't decide who's a journalist. I think anybody can do journalism. I think Oprah does a lot of really good journalism. I think Sean Penn did not.
But you just were yelling about a real journalist. And, you know, the fact of the matter is people go out there and do this. It was a get. I'm sure Rolling Stone is delighted with the get and the quality of the story and that they're having it. And you come in here and you say it's unacceptable.
Well, I tend to side a little more with Alan than Rosemary on this. I think that it was bad journalism on his part, But it was journalism, and if I were the editor of Rolling Stone, I would have no problem with making this decision to send him down there. I would have tried to make his story better once he came back. I would have said, Sean, man,
let's not talk about your penis, Sean. That's not really the point. That would be one thing. And this is also the point of the Pointer Institute that said, yeah, once you got him down there, let's really do journalism. Yeah. They could have helped him with the questions. Nevertheless, we've missed a real opportunity here to get a story about an amazing drug lord who has taken over a country. I think it's insulting to Mexican journalists who have wanted to talk to him. And it really says something about our society. Do you know that the shirts that he wore in the interview, the button-down shirts, are just flying off the shelves? People want to look like El Chapo.
What kind of
world are we in?
Well, that may be a sociological problem, but not a journalistic one, that people are aping this drug lord. And I'm sorry that the journalist in Mexico couldn't get to him, but the fact is the celebrity of Sean Penn enabled him to get there. The connections he made, the very careful way that he built up to get to this, the cloak and dagger steps that he get to. I mean, you have to admire that in a way, because he did manage to get this interview that nobody else could get. The problem was his execution, not the notion. I think the notion of it is fine. Get somebody down there to do the story. I just wish that he'd done it better.
He may end up in jail, you know. I mean, there are all kinds of investigations going on.
I think the First Amendment will protect him, and I would support that.
I'm not done yet.
I know, but I have one last point, and then you can jump in. You talk all the time, Alan. I only get an hour. he had an excellent adventure. Yeah. I would, if I had been presented to me, of course I would have gone down. He had an excellent adventure. But now to suddenly present it as, oh, wow, he showed off all the, real journalists, and he did a great thing. No, he didn't.
Well, he scored an exclusive interview.
Yeah, he did. And am I allowed to say something? Because you're not going to be quiet. This is the first time that Rosemary and I have duked out this story. She said something to me the other day on air, so I don't think it's betraying her confidence. She said, I would have taken it, I would have gone down there, and I would have broken the rules. In other words, not let him have control over what was going to be, not let him read the thing before it was out. And I think that's somewhat dishonest. And I also think it's one of the reasons that people don't, Rosemary, trust journalists, because they say one thing and they do another.
You mean, Rosemary, you would have promised him pre-publication review?
I would have said anything he wanted in order to get the interview. And then when he said, okay, let me see it, I would have talked him out of it. Mm-hmm. And I do that all the time.
You would have promised him anything?
Most journalists do. You agree to certain things and then you talk him out of it later. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
I totally would have done that. He's a drug dealer. Really?
Oh, I agree with that.
He's a man who kills people.
Yeah. I think he's scum.
And, I also have said very vocal things about how I think a certain amount of prostitution has been involved here, trading your name or yourself in order to get something of gain. I think Kate DiCastillo is definitely guilty of that. I think Sean Penn, to a certain extent, is guilty of it. He wanted a great adventure. He wants this notoriety. And it's just awful.
Yeah, you've used the W word. I know that when it comes to prostitution, which...
I think Kate DiCastillo was a whore. She baited him, and the transcripts of the messages between El Chapo and her support my view.
Okay.
Oh, yes, honey, I want to meet you too. Oh, let's meet in the jungle somewhere. I'll bring Sean with. Oh, come on.
But the fact is, it's not a good thing that, you know, somebody promises one set of rules and then does another. That's all I'm saying here.
And actually, one of the good things that resulted is, partly, perhaps as a result of Sibby's contacts, El Chapo is back in custody, and now there is a move to extradite him to the U.S., where he won't be able to escape, we presume.
He'll be in the next cell after Noriega.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They're saying, we'll send him to America, but it could take a year.
Right.
In the meantime, they're moving him from cell to cell every day so that he can't really, dig another tunnel.
Have the tunnel built.
I'm skeptical. Yeah.
So if you have thoughts on this, share them with us, media@wamc.org, and we'll get back to the next week's program, we believe, media@wamc.org. Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith here with you on The Media Project. Let's talk about Philadelphia. All things, how does that line go? All things considered, I'd rather be in Philadelphia. Where's that from? Anyway, help us with that, folks, too. Also, here's something really cool, because there's been a significant problem facing the much-vaunted Philadelphia news organization. That is, one organization actually owns the Philadelphia Daily News, which is the tabloid, the Philadelphia Inquirer, winner of multiple Pulitzer Prizes over the years, and Philly.com, their website. Now, the new owner has decided to donate this to a new not-for-profit institute, and he's pitched in a $20 million endowment.
You mean all three papers?
The two newspapers and the website are all now going to be not-for-profits, like WAMC, basically.
Yeah.
How about that?
Well, you've said many times on this show, Rex, and I want to give you full credit for it. I'm trapping you here, of course, that one of the looks of the new journalism may well be not-for-profit. And that's because newspapers, many newspapers, are operating at a not-for-profit basis. Meaning they're not making any money.
Intentionally.
So what do you think about that? You know, people would give money to their newspaper to support them in the same way they may give money to WAMC and put it into their lockbox. This is something that's going on right now.
But, by the way, after we talked about last week's show, we made some little joke about the Times Union needing a lockbox. And a guy came up to me as I was walking across the University of Albany campus and stuffed a dollar bill in my pocket and said, "Here, this is for the Times Union lockbox. I'm a supporter."
That's pretty funny.
So I got a buck. You got a million. So
I don't think it's right.
Anyway.
Sounds like a stripper, doesn't it?
It's a...
sticking money in his pocket.
Well, there's so much of this stuff that, you know, you made a point earlier, Rosemary. I can't let it go by that it's prostitution when one person does it. But the whole earth operates on a prostitutional basis. In other words, what? Some 26-year-old gets married to... Rupert Murdoch, or
She's 59, actually.
59-year-old Murdoch, who's 84. And we say, oh, isn't that nice? They're getting married.
No, I use the W word for her, too.
Well, how do we know that? We don't know what's in their heart.
But let me just say that we're going to get a lot of mail on the W word.
Well, you know, words are interesting.
People don't like it because they think it's sexist and it's not right.
Yeah,
really?
I actually had a debate on this on my Facebook because I used the word, to me, the definition of whoring or prostitution is to trade yourself for money or something of other.
And wives, 26-year-olds who marry 80-year-olds?
Correct. I think the word fits there. However, many people tell me that, no, whore has been used only against women and to denote sexual promiscuity, I think is a whole different thing, but that's the way the nuance of the word is different than the definition.
And so I've heard guys call journalistic whores.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we need to be a little bit less sensitive about precise words like that, and let's just allow for the evolution of language, and let's...
Like the Donald says, you know, stop this political correctness. Let's just talk.
All right, Donald. Anyway, it's a cool thing. You know, the one thing that actually this not-for-profit thing does is it exempts the Philadelphia media from federal taxes. That is a great advantage that not-for-profits have over profit-making enterprises, and it's why a lot of investigative reporting is now being done by not-for-profit organizations, and they in turn distribute their stuff through for-profit enterprises, like in the Bay Area of San Francisco, where the San Francisco Chronicle, owned by, full disclosure, my company, Hearst, has trimmed its staff significantly in an effort to avoid operating a deficit constantly. But there's a very aggressive not-for-profit newsroom out there, Center for Investigative Reporting, that does great work and then publishes its stuff in the for-profit newspaper. So
yeah, it's an interesting model. The question is, will it work in Philadelphia? And is it translatable to other areas? Like, could the Times Union end up in a nonprofit? And then there is the long-term instability of this kind of funding. Nonprofits can turn their attention to other kind of interests. They may want to do health next year, or they may want to do peace and war kind of mediation instead of working on media. And where does that leave you? So I really, really wanted them to find a better business model that would put it on secure footing.
Well,
but in the meantime, better to have journalism than nothing.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I disagree with you, and that's only respectfully, Rosemary.
Of course.
Respectfully. Bless your heart. you know, I think we're in an evolutionary stage. It's a term that Rex has used many times. You've used it yourself. In a convergence stage, public radio, public television, we're all sort of newspapers. We're all sort of coming together. Look, we're sitting here today with Rex Smith, the vaunted editor, and I mean that, of the Albany Times Union. Earlier today, we had his chief political reporter in our studios to do another show. We have his associate editor in here, Mike Spain, who does a terrific job. So everybody realizes now that instead of acting on a competitive model, we're beginning to understand that we all help each other in the news business, and it helps everybody.
Absolutely.
What was that face you just
made? Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, we're all raised Americans, and capitalism teaches that competition's really a good thing. So if we're all competing together, that means you're going to get one or two really great stories, but what about all the other ones for which there's not immediate funding and sexy attention from people? What happens to those stories? So, no, I'm not exactly in love with this model. I think our old model was better, but I do recognize
the old model's not working.
Exactly.
Well, actually, the old model of competition in journalism fueled a lot of shallow, quick journalism. That is the let's not look back with too much glory at the golden age of American journalism when newspapers were competing for scoops rather than doing deep reporting. Deep reporting is actually helped by solid funding. And if that comes from not-for-profit, that's great. Competition does not always produce the best work. It does produce lower-cost work, usually. It often produces a drive for what will please consumers rather than what will really serve them. So competition is not always a great thing in this world.
I have to admit that is true, but I would say the same of nonprofit ownership. Just because it's a nonprofit doesn't mean you're going to get unlimited money. It doesn't mean they're going to work on stories that are like deeply important and meaningful. You're going to see a lot of flash in Philadelphia, too, because they need to attract readers.
Absolutely.
And advertisers.
And then there's always the question of motive. Why is this guy giving this thing to a not-for-profit? Maybe because he sees the train coming down the track and it does not look attractive. And if he gives it away with a hunk of money, which he's doing, he stays ahead of the game.
Yeah, but I think he just bought it. He's not the longtime owner. He just really acquired it. And I think it is genuinely, Mr. Lenfest is his name. I think it's Jerry Lenfest. I think he genuinely wanted to preserve the strong voice of journalism in one of America's great cities, which has been imperiled.
When you come from South Dakota, I'll tell you one thing. You always look for the good thing to say.
Yeah, we're raised optimistic out there. Oh, good old America. Here we are. Looking back to a story that we dealt with, actually this ties in a little bit with the first topic of Rolling Stone publishing the Sean Penn story. We were chastising Rolling Stone here just a few months ago because of the false story about the rape at the University of Virginia, which was published 14 months ago and really transformed for a while the conversation about rape on American campuses. Turns out, however, of course, that the story was false. Rolling Stone retracted it, paid for an investigation led by the Columbia Journalism School dean. Now, here's a big question, and this is something that Rosemary in particular has been interested in the past. Here's a question. The rape story turned out to be false. The young woman who raised the allegation that she was raped on the campus at University of Virginia has never been named. Why hasn't she been named? Should she be named?
Well, now, Rosemary has been very vocal on this issue.
Yeah, I think she should have been named all along. I think had we used her real name, we wouldn't have had this false story to report with. I think that newspapers particularly, but all the media, have taken this paternalistic view that we have to protect and coddle sexual abuse victims, that we have to protect them from public scrutiny. We do not do this with any other victim of a crime. And I believe it perpetuates the idea that these crime victims are somehow different, that they're kind of complicit in what happened to them. I think it adds to the idea that if you were raped or attacked, man, maybe you were a little responsible, so we're going to protect you from public scrutiny. I have never liked it. I would not ever have a blanket policy, you know, that you have to name all victims because you've got to look at each case. But we have a blanket policy of never naming anybody. I have covered rapes in which the women have asked to be covered and the paper would not run their names. That's also wrong. In this case, it's not even clear that Jackie committed a rape, but she is involved in court cases that have to do with her story. She has maligned a university and a fraternity, and I do not understand why her name is not used.
Yeah, I agree, generally speaking. I really like your point that we don't have blanket policies on naming victims of other crimes. We make judgments about
it. And even in sensitive places like the mentally ill. What?
Yes.
You think the mentally ill don't have issues with being named?
Right.
We name them?
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Really, we make judgments. And I think rape is one of those circumstances. Now, that viewpoint is not universally shared. I'm reading from a story in which Kristen Hauser, who is a spokeswoman for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, social services organization, says, we still have an environment overall that is hostile and suspicious of people who say they were sexually assaulted. And so she says that it's best to leave it up to the survivors.
This debate goes back decades now. In 1991, the Des Moines Register under Geneva Overholser ran a story that won a Pulitzer Prize in which they chronicled the experience of a rape victim, named her with her agreement. It was a remarkably authentic and moving story. And it did more to bring attention to rape than this story, which, of course, has a fake name on it. I think we've moved backwards on it. And I'd like women to own this. We get controlled by the fear of rape. I keep using the example of Saudi Arabia, where one of the arguments for not letting women drive is that they might get pulled over by the side of the road and raped. So you can't have the freedom of driving. Rape is used to control us, and then when it does happen to us, we cower and don't talk about it, and we say, oh, they won't listen to me, they won't believe me. We really need to take this over. The Bill Cosby story is very educational to me. Women have finally said enough.
Well, well said, Rosemary, and thanks for bringing that up, Rex. But I wanted to go to another place just for a moment.
What's that, Alan? And what's on your mind? Please.
Governor Cuomo gave a very, very long
state of the state address. State of the Union. Yep.
And he raised the journalistic issue in the course of that state of the state, which is the freedom of information laws, and expanding it. And that, it seems to me, may come from directly from the Department of Hypocrisy. Because,
yep.
because in this very setting, you have complained many times that when you've tried to get stuff for your newspaper, which after all covers the state capitol, they have been very, very reticent to give you what you want.
He just vetoed two open government bills that he could have signed that were passed overwhelmingly by both houses of the legislature. He vetoed them and then announced half-baked efforts to supposedly do what those bills would have done better. What he did was, there is currently a provision in law that allows judges, if they wish, to reimburse, to order that public officials who intentionally withhold data that is supposed to be revealed under the Freedom of Information Law, if they intentionally withhold it and a judge finds that they did so without any real pretense of the law supporting them, they would have to pay the legal costs of the individual or the news organization who brought suit to release it. That is, if I've got to go to court to get a document that should be presumptively available, I shouldn't have to pay a lawyer for that. And we've recovered tens of thousands of dollars from governments, City of Albany, the state of New York, the legislature, that is, under this provision. But this little bill would have changed that. A judge may make that provision to a judge shall, so that it just strengthens the law. So that if public officials intentionally violate the Freedom of Information Law, they will be held to account for it. The governor vetoed that, and there was no reason for that to be vetoed if you really support open government.
All of his efforts seem pegged on bringing the legislature under the guise of the Freedom of Information Act. That has never been the case, not on the federal level or in any state that I'm aware of, that legislature is subject. It would be great if it was, but the truth is you don't really need it. When you've got opposing parties, you always can get somebody to talk.
Well,
so the governor is saying...
I don't agree with that at all.
It's true, though.
No,
the governor is saying my package would bring the legislature in. The problem is it will never pass.
Yeah.
The legislature has no interest at all.
Well, it's his way of giving them a soft punch in the underbelly.
Yeah, and basically pretending to be an advocate of open government when, in fact, his administration does not.
So aren't you glad that I brought that up?
I'm really glad you did. And furthermore, he vetoed a bill that would have reduced the amount of time that government agencies can stall before deciding whether to grant an appeal.
Right. And they do that all the time.
They stall like crazy. You'll be waiting a year. Most notably, in our case, we've really run into problems with the Department of Corrections and Community Services, which runs the state prisons in New York State. And we've had outrageous stalling on their part. And now we know that that agency is under investigation. I think there ought to be a federal prosecutor appointed to look into the state prison system, because we have found instances where the oversight agency there, the Inspector General of DOCS, in fact, has been running an office that seems to be permeated by favoritism and cover-ups. I think there needs to be a thorough investigation, and the governor hasn't spoken to that issue.
Yeah. One other thing I'd like to say before we go, and that is here in New York State, the U.S. prosecutor, Preet Bharara, this week announced that there, quote, wasn't enough evidence to prosecute the governor for ending the infamous Moreland Act Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love the idea that people use words in such a way to have real meaning. If you say, you know, there's no evidence that anything happened, that's one thing. But if you say there wasn't enough evidence that something happened, you know what you're doing.
It does seem like it was very carefully thought out in terms of what he wanted to say there. Not enough evidence. I mean, maybe we're putting too much into it, but it does seem to me as though Preet Bharara said,
stay tuned.
Yeah. And so everybody was looking, well, does this mean he's...
Well, even in making that announcement, he made clear that he hasn't stopped looking into some of the material that the Moreland Commission collected on other people doing wrong, maybe the governor. And there's also the investigation into the Buffalo Billions, which certainly could take a look at the governor, too. So I don't think there's any way you can look at what happened as a vindication of the governor.
And it will remain a great topic for journalists. You know, we will all try to find out what it is that he's finding out. We're all trying to replicate some of his investigation to see if we can get at some of this material ourselves. And it's very difficult, because unless you have reporters who are there every day in the U.S. Federal prosecutor's office, this is in downstate, you're not going to be able to get any access to material.
Well, I'm interested to see if the prosecutor gets an invitation to come to Albany to talk about ethics reform, as he got want to go to Kentucky.
Yeah. Well, the Assembly Republicans have invited him, but they... Yeah.
And he has an open invitation to appear before these microphones anytime he wants.
Very kind of you. He could come to our office, too.
Yeah,
but he
could
come to
your come to the university.
Sure, come on around.
To,
yeah. And we'd probably be just as nice to him as as Sean Penn was to El Chapo.
Or as the old...
We'll all start dressing like him.
Or as the old song in the 1950s, I don't know, Teresa Brewer, who sang, Come On to My House.
Come on to my house.
That was Rosemary Clooney.
Rosemary Clooney, you're absolutely right. And you would know that because...
Because her name is the same as mine, so I've heard that song since the day I was born.
We got to go. Thanks for joining us on the Media Project.
Such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.